Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
A mid-morning dance with the devil from the Farmer of Fury.
Dangerous mid-morning debate with the Great Dictator.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on the day that the papers are overflowing once more with more pictures of the happy royal couple who showed off baby Archie. Can we just stop now, please? Enough already, even though they named the little boy after me. Back in the real world, we've got more important things to discuss, and we're kicking off with a disturbing report about how big companies are actually killing capitalism. Lord Tyree, the head of the Competition and Markets Authority, has warned that consumers have been ripped off for so long they are now actually losing faith in the systems altogether. The main culprits, he says, are banks, insurance firms, energy companies and huge online retailers who charge whatever they think they can get away with for goods and services. Has he got a point? Well, I'm not sure he has, actually. I think he's actually reflecting what an awful lot of people think who don't know what they're talking about. And in fact, it might be truer to say that more and more people have lost faith in democracy and in the House of Lords and in the House of Commons in this country. 0344 499 1000. Coming up, we'll be finding out why 70% of cyclists in this country fear for their safety while they're out and about on the roads. There's no doubt the hostility between cyclists and other drivers has reached an all-time high. But who's really to blame for that? I think it's the people handing the roads to the two-wheeling brigade and creating division, i.e. the politicians, people like Sadiq Khan and others all up and down the country. 0344 499 1000. Also, we'll be asking just how dangerous is the world getting as Donald Trump threatens Iran. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo calls Jeremy Corbyn disgusting for supporting Maduro in Venezuela. And the Chinese are vowing to retaliate against trade war tariffs from America. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, Lord Tyree's an interesting guy. He sits in the House of Lords. He's a former Tory minister, served under Michael Howard. He was a guy who worked for the Tory party. I think he was elected for the first time in 1997. He's not quite a snouts in the trough type. He's been there for years and years and years and years. But he is a man who is supposed to be in charge of something which you would think is fairly capitalistic in its makeup, the Competition and Markets Authority. I think there's no question that people are fed up being ripped off by banks, being ripped off by energy companies, being ripped off by insurance companies. But does that really mean that people have got some kind of crisis of confidence in capitalism itself? We know that there's an awful lot of young people who think Jeremy Corbyn is the next best thing since sliced bread and that he should be running the country. I don't think anybody sensible actually thinks that, though, do they? 0344 499 1000. We'll take loads of your calls coming up. But let's talk to Robert Colville, editor of CapEx, first of all. Robert, very good morning to you.
Morning.
Well, welcome to the Independent Republic. This is a place which celebrates capitalism, rather more probably than most, because I'm one of those who, if it had been up to me, would not have saved the banks from going bankrupt. I would have just let them go bankrupt, because that's what capitalism tells you should happen.
I think all of this, to be honest, comes back to the financial crisis. It comes back to 2008, and the young people you're talking about, you know, that they're sort of opening experience of capitalism and the economy was the entire thing falling off the cliff.
Yes,
and then having sort of 10 really quite grueling years afterwards. So it's no wonder. People have not lost faith in capitalism. People have not lost faith in competition. But you know, their trust in, as you say, politicians, big business, you know, the guys at the top of the system, you know, they're not that happy with them.
Have have they lost faith perhaps in what they're being told is capitalism? Because people like Jeremy Corbyn are quite good at telling everyone that capitalism has got us into this terribly unfair situation where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer and the gap between the two becomes larger. The fact that people are avoiding paying tax, even though lots of people actually do pay tax. The fact that, you know, somehow it's you're now an evil individual if you want to go out and make a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, the diagnosis is right. The cure is absolutely wrong. And this is actually where Tarek's speech comes in. I mean, the essential point is capitalism works when there's competition. You know, the reason that you can get, you know, like when you walk out of your office for lunch today, that you'll have like 8, 9, 10 different choices. Admittedly, 5 of them will be present one day. But you know, you can buy some, you know, really good food really cheaply. That's the market where competition works.
Yeah.
But then you go to something, as you say, you know, like the you know, energy companies, maybe banking. The one he's actually focused on is accountancy and audit. You know, there are these markets where increasingly, because of regulation, because of the way the economy is moving, you know, you're getting at this kind of concentration of very, very, very large companies. And all the evidence is absolutely clear. You know, the fewer companies you have in a market, the more they have a market to themselves, the more profits they make, the lazier they get. One of the great big challenges for us is to work out how we try and fix that.
Mm. Is it an issue of regulation, do you think, then, Robert? Because, I mean, of course, in true sort of pure capitalism, there is no regulation and the market kind of regulates itself. And if you go to the wall, you go to the wall. If you're able to charge loads and loads of money for something and people will still pay it, then that's happening. However, we don't really quite operate like that. We operate a system of kind of diluted capitalism where we have regulators who tell the banks what they can and can't do. Are they not doing their job properly, do you think?
I think obviously you need regulation. I mean, you need to clean air, you know, there are all sorts of areas where clean water, where you need to set standards. The problem we have at the moment is that quite often the regulation is set. You know, the people who regulate our economy generally what often happens, with internet regulation, banking regulation, whatever, is there are unintended consequences. It makes it. Once you impose a certain level of regulation, it becomes much, much harder for a new company to enter the market. You know, there are some markets where it's like a natural monopoly. Like, you know, if I were to try and set up a new search engine, I'd be an idiot because Google is everyone just uses Google. There's network effects there. But you know, if I wanted to try and set up a new bank, it's much harder. I should be if I wanted to set up a new accountancy company. And you mentioned. And the housing crisis is actually a really good example of this. What happened was after 2008, the bank said, "Oh my God, we gave mortgages to lots and lots of people who shouldn't have had mortgages. So now we're going to impose really, really tight restrictions."
Yeah, and basically now we're not going to give any to anybody.
Yeah, and what you've left with is about 2 million people we've worked out who would have had. Who've got jobs, who've got an impeccable record, you know, they've always paid in, you know, they can afford mortgages, but they can't afford deposits, and that's partly because of house prices rocketing up, which is again about our planning regulations, but also because they can't, the banks are told, you know, you can only lend to people who have who tick boxes X, Y, and Z rather than A, B, and C.
Yes, I mean, some of what Lord Tyrie says does ring a bell and will be resonant with an awful lot of people, which is that the more loyal you are as a customer nowadays, the less well off you become with that particular company. Like, if you're a new subscriber to Sky TV, you'll probably get a better deal than if you're currently with them. Similarly, you'll get a better deal from an energy company to sign up with them than you will if you've been with them for 10 years. I mean, why can they not, the regulator, do things about that?
I mean, they can. This is like in energy companies, you can say, hey, the solution to this is to nationalise all the energy companies, which would cost a lot of money and not really work very well. Or you can say, we're going to push switching, we're going to let people move. The problem is that actually where there is a need for regulation is that what's happened in the energy market in particular is that the people who don't move, who have just sat on the same tariff, quite often they're elderly people, they're not checking the internet, they're not engaged with their decisions. They're just sort of sitting there and letting it happen to them. So from memory, it's about like a third of customers who just sort of sit there and they sat there on the highest tariff. And then the government said, actually, actually that's wrong. And you should either try and make people aware that there are other options out there, or just push them to switch. You know, say, look, you can't if you've just been sitting there with the same company, we need to kind of have a big flashing alarm bell going, you do realise you are losing quite a lot of money here.
Yes. Yeah, but then again, that puts it into the arms of the consumer to sort their life out, I suppose. And a lot of people, either one, don't have the time or the inclination or even maybe the wherewithal to do that. And so, you know, I'm in two minds about this one, to be honest, because on the one hand, if it's like caveat emptor. If you can't actually go out and sort yourself out and get yourself a better deal, then that's your problem. However, I just feel as though it's a bit like with train companies. You know, I feel like I'm being ripped off every time I buy a railway ticket because I don't believe that they're offering me the same price as somebody else. And they're in the wrong for doing that, it seems to me.
Yeah, but again, that's an area where actually, the government is telling train companies how much to raise their prices by. It's telling them where they can, they're telling them how they can do. It's saying, obviously, a railway line is, it's harder to have competition on it, but especially on the long distance route, it's not impossible.
No, quite. And do you think that Lord Tyree has a point, though, that the more this goes on, perhaps the more people will kind of walk away from what they believe to be capitalism and will become a more left-wing society as a result, and people will then elect politicians who they think will battle capitalism?
Yeah, I mean, we've done some polling, and it's really running CapEx, I also run a think tank called the Centre for Policy Studies, and okay. We do some polling on what young people think, and it's really clear they're completely rational consumers. They believe that everyone should have the same opportunity, but we shouldn't enforce the same outcomes. They believe in competition. They believe in choice. They also believe, they're not going to have enough savings when they hit retirement, that their lives are going to be worse than their parents, that, when you're going to be able to afford a home, the most popular answer is never. Mm. Is that what you think?
No.
And obviously they've had a long period after the financial crisis in which real wages have been kind of stagnant or falling, which isn't going to make anyone feel good about anything.
No, of course.
So the job of politicians, and I mean, this is actually why what Tyree was saying is quite welcome, and what quite a lot of the other politicians out there are saying, if we stop saying, okay, let's just accept that we're not going to have much growth and that we're kind of stuck with this, and actually let's do do whatever the hell we can to put more money in people's pockets, to make sure that companies are fighting for their loyalty, that they deserve their loyalty. I think, capitalism is the most utterly wonderful system when it has competition in it, when it has choice, when you, the consumer, the little guy, are in control.
And also when you get to keep more of the money that you make and thereby spend it in a way that you would like to spend it rather than giving it all to the government who would like to spend it the way they want to spend it.
Completely. We need to fund public services, we need to fund the NHS, we need to pay for social care, we need to put police on the streets. But when you actually talk to people, are you paying enough in tax? Would you like to pay some more? Everyone goes, no, I'm paying, of course I don't want to pay any more tax. We need to be really, really smart about what we spend. And we need to figure out however we can to put more money in people's pockets, because then they go out and spend it.
Well, also, we're getting into a place now, I feel, where the parliament and the parliamentarians that serve us, supposedly, have rather forgotten what it is that they're supposed to be doing. They think we work for them as opposed to them working for us. I mean, we're now being told, for example, today, and we're going to talk about this later on, that the cladding project, which is going to cost 200 million quid, is going to be paid for by the taxpayer. They're going to find the money some other way rather than actually finding it from government coffers. We're also being told that, the end of the world is nigh and it's all our fault. So we have to pay more taxes and we have to, somehow do more things to prevent areas from flooding, to prevent the climate crisis, and it's all coming out of our money that we make. It's not coming out of anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, government doesn't have money. There's no, government has the money it takes from us. Mm. And I mean, there's a reason that politicians keep on saying, look, you need a strong economy to pay for the public services. You can't just say, we need all of this money for all of these things, and the rich will pay, or the corporations will pay, because when you actually crunch the numbers, no matter how many rich people there are, no matter how many corporations, they're not rich enough to pay for all of the stuff that all of us want.
No, they really aren't. I mean, do you think this is going to get worse before it gets any better? Because we do seem to be in a very kind of uncertain place at the moment politically. We don't seem to really have... We've got the two-party system, which is being kind of ripped asunder by Brexit, so that people are dividing themselves up on different lines. It's now, another evil, if you're a Brexit supporter, if you're a middle-class person who wants to stay in the European Union, you're very virtuous. It's all gone a bit weird, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in the Conservative Party, for example, but if you take Brexit out of the equation, actually everyone pretty much agrees with each other. But if you take Brexit out of the equation, it's a really, really big and borderline impossible thing to say. I think the truth is it's not just about Brexit. I worked at the Daily Telegraph when we did the expenses scandal.
Yeah,
people have been sort of annoyed with how things are working. People have felt without working. For a very long time. And that's kind of a natural human condition. We don't sit there and go, the railway companies, the energy companies are more productive and efficient than they were under public ownership. And actually, we can buy a sandwich now for, £3.75, right, which is, would have had a value back then of £15 because it has these rare ingredients. Which, yeah. That's good. We are massively impatient. We want our lives to get better. And it's the job of the economy and it's the job of politicians to do that. And the best way politicians can do that quite often, I think, is, getting out of the way and just absolutely saying, you want to set up a company, go ahead. You want to live your life, go ahead. We're going to make sure you have as much of your own money. We're going to make life as easy as possible for you, but we're also going to make sure that you're not ripped off in the process. I think that's quite a good manifesto.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think in that case, Robert, as well, the companies have to play their part too. Thanks very much indeed, Robert Colville, editor of CapEx. There, pretty much agreeing with me that it's not capitalism that's failing; it is what is being described as capitalism, which is ripping people off, and that is not necessarily capitalism at all. But I think it's true to say that the insurance companies, the energy companies, the railway companies, the big banks—they all need to play their part in making sure that people don't feel ripped off. Because if they do, and they think that somehow big companies and big business is the enemy, then you start to lean to the left, then you start to lean towards Jeremy Corbyn, and then you start to worry about what it is that the society is going to become, where people are going to be punished for being successful, people are going to be looked upon as evil for trying to make money and to try to do well for themselves and their families. And that is not the kind of country that I want to live in, to be honest.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
I got my mind set.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio, 0344 499 1000. We've just been talking about how the government and the capitalist system in this country is failing in some ways because of the way that people are perceiving it effectively, in the way that some people are seeing money being wasted in some areas, other people are seeing themselves being ripped off by banks, by building societies, by insurance companies, by big energy firms as well. We've got the news this morning. One of the big news stories that we're breaking here on Talk Radio is the government has set up a £200 million fund to replace unsafe Grenfell Tower-style cladding on around about 170 private high-rise residential buildings. Now, this was supposed to have been paid for by the owners of those buildings, who seemingly have been dragging their feet and not really doing anything about it. So the government has now stepped in and said this money will be made available to building owners to remove the aluminium composite material cladding. It's basically saying if these reckless building owners won't act, the government will. Well, should we be paying for it, I suppose, is the big question. Alex Dibble has been following the story for us here at Talk Radio. Alex, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
This is going to be a very controversial thing, I suppose. Obviously, everybody wants to see it done, but as to who pays for it seems to be the issue.
And that's been one of the reasons why it's taken this long for anything to happen. The government stepped in today with this, as you said, £200 million. But to be frank, the residents of these blocks have been calling for help for 18 months, 2 years, ever since Grenfell.
Yeah.
Because every night they've gone to sleep in a block that could go up in flames,
sure.
and they could, have the same fate as those
it's
who
quite
tragically
shocking,
lost their
really,
lives.
That still is the case all these months later.
It is, and one of the reasons why it's taken this long is because of this legal uncertainty about who was liable. Were the developers, were the freeholders, were the government? Certainly the residents said, we shouldn't be paying and we can't afford to, because we saved up all our money to buy these flats and we don't have any extra money, so they couldn't do it. The government have said £200 million, but many people are saying today that that's not enough, because it only covers aluminium based cladding and not other types of cladding. And there are hundreds of blocks across the country, Manchester, Sheffield, Liverpool, Kent, you name it.
Well, funnily enough,
other types of cladding.
After Grenfell happened, I remember driving around London and suddenly just noticing how many buildings had that kind of cladding on, which I'd never really noticed before. And I suspect a lot of people would have been the same.
Expect a massive legal battle after this, because even though the government are stumping up the money now, make no mistake, they don't believe they should be paying because they've already said the developers should and the leaseholders shouldn't.
Right.
And they don't believe that they should be paying. So expect a huge legal battle for them to try and recoup that money from the private companies who they believe should be footing the bill.
Right, who will no doubt be paying millions to lawyers to make sure they don't have to. Let's talk to, stay with us if you will, Alex. Let's talk to Ritu Saha, who lives in a building with cladding. We're going to find out from her what her experience has been. Ritu, a very good morning to you. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
No, thanks for joining us. You live in somewhere called the North Point Building, I understand, in Bromley, sort of southeast London. What's been your situation?
So our situation is that our building has got both ACM and non-ACM cladding,
right.
All of which has been categorized as having the highest level of risk, category 3. So we've been told that we need to get all three kinds of cladding off our building before it can be certified as safe. And at the moment, we have 24-hour patrols called waiting watches, which has cost us more than £220,000 last year. Two residents of the building, and we residents undertake waking watches ourselves overnight and after work in order to keep these costs down.
And are you mostly renters in that building? How many units would you say are in there, if you know?
So there are 57 flats, and it is the leaseholders who are paying for all of these interim measures and have been told to pay for the recladding. So, and we are a mix of, people who've retired and purchased their final home, young professionals, families who've bought their first home there, and a very small buy-to-let landlords who maybe have one property which they were using as their pension, which has now gone down the drain, unfortunately.
Ritu, it's Alex. You and I were at that meeting last night in Westminster with the all-party parliamentary group on this issue, and Kit Malthouse, the housing minister, was meant to be there, was meant to be addressing you as a leaseholder and other people as well. He didn't show up. Do you think now you can see, hang on, he didn't show up because if he'd announced this fund to you, there would have been a massive backlash in the room by people who are in buildings without ACM cladding with a different type who would have just looked at him straight in the eye and said, that's not good enough.
That's absolutely right, Alex. And as you were in the room, you would know that we did a show of hands to show how many leaseholders were facing problems other than ACM cladding, such as non-ACM and such as internal fire safety defects. And it was, more than 50%. In fact, more than two-thirds of the people in the room were facing those kinds of problems. So it's very clear that the reason that Mr. Malthouse may have avoided that meeting was because there would have been a backlash because, after months of fighting and talking about this issue, it appears that the crux of the issue has not really been grasped by Mr. Malthouse and the MHCLG as to the extent of the problem that needs to be fixed and why this fund, while welcome, will actually not go far enough to making our homes safe and actually puts many of us in more difficulty than we are currently in.
And not because, obviously, finance is the main thing here, because safety clearly is, I'd have to say, Ritu.
Absolutely.
What is the effect of all of this on the value of the property that you're in?
So at the moment, our properties do not have any value. None of the flats in our block have sold since we discovered that the cladding was unsafe in November of 2017. We have not been able to get any mortgages on our properties. And the handful of landlords who are trying to find new tenants, if their old tenants have moved out, have been now told as well by many estate agents that we are not going to be finding tenants for flats in this particular block as it is unsafe. So we have a situation where we are living in this block, which is so unsafe that an estate agent would not ask a general member of the public to rent that particular property. And here we are, 2 years on from the tragedy at Grenfell, still having to say that we need government funds to fix this problem. Because at the end of the day, when we are talking about funds, it is not about taxpayer funds. It is about asking the question as to how was this material put on our buildings? who approved it? How was it deemed as safe to be put on so many buildings and is now being deemed unsafe? And if you look at it, that boils down to the failure of government regulations. And if it boils down to the failure of government regulations, then surely it is the responsibility of government to fix it. So, that's why we've been calling for a fund to fix not just ACM, but non-ACM cladding as well as all the internal fire safety defects, the myriad internal fire safety defects that have been discovered in many of these buildings post-Grenfell, which are going to cost millions of pounds to fix. And unfortunately, the funds that have been announced today are not going to cover any of that, nor are they going to cover any interim fire safety measures.
Ritu, I want to get your thoughts on this, and Mike, you'll be interested in this as well, because we've talked a lot about how non-ACM cladding hasn't been covered by this. Tests, I believe, have started on other types of cladding, government tests, to decipher how flammable those other materials are. Zinc, for example, there have been big question marks over zinc. Now, I understand that those test results should come back in the summer, and the government have indicated to me this morning that based on the outcome of those tests, if they suggest that there's an immediate public safety concern, that they will consult their experts urgently and consider appropriate action. So, Ritu, does that give you hope, perhaps, that non-ACM cladding may well end up being covered by another fund, perhaps, if the results show that they're equally flammable?
That does give me a lot of hope. However, we have been discussing this for 22 months, and the government has had ample time to carry out this testing on these other kinds of cladding. And my question to the government would be, will we need to wait another 22 months for the outcome of these tests and for the government to move its feet? Because at the moment, the leaseholders at North Point are still stuck in limbo. We're still left with these different kinds of cladding, and we still have the waking watch on our property, and we don't know when our building will be made safe, and it's quite possible that our building owner may try to tap into this £200 million fund that exists and say, okay, hang on, give me a $500,000 that will be required to remove the ACM panels, and for the rest of it I will just build the leaseholders in the block, which will put us in an incredibly difficult situation, because then we will probably have to fork out £50,000-£60,000 per flat, because our building owner is putting pressure on us. If we are unable to pay, that will lead to lease forfeiture and the loss of our homes. So there are a lot of different scenarios that may happen as a result of this government announcement for blocks which have mixed types of cladding in them. And I'm not sure whether the minister has actually thought this through. I've just had a chat with the minister, in fact, before speaking to you, and I have put these questions through to him, and he has said he will consider them, but he was unfortunately unable to give a response to me when I spoke to him earlier today.
That'll be James Brokenshire. Ritu, thank you very much indeed. Ritu Saha, terrible situation for a lot of these people. And an interesting tweet here, Alex, from somebody who's called Deep House, who basically says £200 million to reclad 170 buildings sounds woefully optimistic. How do you remove cladding 200 feet up in any case? That's a lot of scaffolding times 170. And what will be a safe replacement? And will the suppliers charge a fair price? Policy making on the hoof as usual. It does look a bit like that, doesn't it?
And you've got this other issue, which I think is really interesting. Why is cladding on the side of these buildings? It's insulation.
Yeah.
Now, it's flammable. That's a problem. But it's insulation. Yeah. That's why it's on there. If you take it off and you don't replace it with anything, suddenly the heating bills of everyone in that building is going to skyrocket. They won't be able to afford that. So you have to put something in its place.
Was it not the case that some said that some of the cladding was put up for sort of cosmetic purposes as well?
Some was, yes. But there are lots that were put up for genuine insulation purposes. Right. If nothing is put up there, you just have these incredibly unattractive blocks. Now, that's better than a block that looks nice but isn't safe, of course. But there are so many other little details about this, little in comparison to the big one, but still major issues in and of themselves, that also need to get sorted out.
Absolutely right. Alex, thank you very much indeed. Alex Dibble will bring you all the news on the cladding story throughout the day here at Talk Radio as it develops, because the government have said that they're going to pledge £200 million, but it's clearly not going to be enough, and there are clearly a lot more questions than there are answers at this point. Well, of course there are. This is the Tory government of Theresa May we're talking about. 0344 499 1000 is the number. We'll take loads more of your calls coming up.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
More gun talk from a water pistol from the Farmer of Fury.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham
on Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham, you know what to do. We've got loads of great tweets coming in, particularly on the cycling front. Chris says, in Holland, the environment is designed for cycling. In the UK, it's the public who aren't designed for cycling. Certainly the roads in large parts of this country are not designed for cycling, I'd have to say. Here's one from Punk Jock, who says, the rules are we should overtake parked cars, bikes and horses, giving a car door width minimum. But as you say, most drive on the pavement anyway. Well, that's not true to say that. I mean, I think the trouble is, there's an awful lot of generalisations that get made, but I can guarantee you, as I said earlier to our cycling guests, if you go and stand on a street corner in the centre of London where bikes and cars and taxis and buses and lorries and vans coexist, you will see, I would guarantee you, an incident involving a cyclist at least once every 15 minutes. Sometimes it's the cyclist's fault, sometimes it's not. But there is a problem and we need to figure it out. 0344 499 1000. A lot of you want to talk about the cladding situation as well. Let's talk to Ed, who's in Newport down in Wales. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Mike. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Very great pleasure. Thank you very much.
I used to listen to a rival station, but I don't anymore. I listen to you.
Top man. Very well played. Congratulations for being sensible.
Can I just touch on the cycling thing very quickly?
Yeah.
I mean, for a start off, a lot of cyclists use, I already pay my road tax. I've got a car.
Yeah.
For every car you have, you've got to pay road tax. So that's
right.
Not really an argument.
I don't think it is. And as somebody earlier pointed out, if you've got a motorcycle, you have to get a separate road tax for the motorcycle. So why not for the bike?
Exactly. Yeah. I agree with you on most things, but I don't agree with you on your argument with sort of individuals or companies having to pay for the cladding, the recladding, if you like, of buildings.
Okay.
Purely because, I mean, when you build a new building, you have to obviously build it to building regs at that time. It's at that time. It's not retrospective or in the future. It's at that time the building law is.
Yes.
So, I mean, basically, those were clad at that time. It was building law. It was the government authorised that building to be built like that. Therefore, the government should be paying it, not individual companies.
Well, it's not quite as simple as that, though, Ed, is it? Because you're right to say that the government allowed those buildings to be clad in that way. But partly the reason, that my understanding is, you may know better than me, but my understanding is the reason why a lot of the cladding was passed as suitable was because it wasn't properly inspected. The commercial kind of materials being used were not properly looked at, and there was no real proper testing for safety.
That was my next argument, actually.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the as you might know, the BBA, the British Board of Agreement, are the persons involved in testing of building materials that are suitable for cladding. For every part of a building element, that building material would have been tested to certain standards. You have fire doors, floors, everything would have been tested to certain standards.
Right.
So, I mean, that they are the people that really should be culpable, if you like, for this thing going wrong. I mean, there must have been something going wrong for that product to be in that situation. But I mean, at the end, ultimately, building inspectors or so forth would have probably looked at that building and said, yeah, at this time, this building's fine, here's your certificate. So it would have been the local authority
yes.
at the time.
I totally see your argument, Ed, but my sympathies are not with the people who are the owners of the buildings. My sympathies are with the people living in those buildings. And I think if 2 years later, after such a terrible event as Grenfell, that the owners haven't really even bothered themselves to attempt to do it, except to pass it all on to the leaseholders and the people that live there. I mean, what sort of people are they? Do they really want to see another situation like Grenfell existing in a building that they own?
No, it's horrendous, yeah.
It's awful, isn't it? But listen, your point is well made, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much indeed. Dave is in Hinckley. Hello, Dave.
Hello there. You all right?
Yeah, very well. What do you want to say?
Just about this cladding.
Yeah.
If the government... say this building's not fit for purpose, it's dangerous,
yeah,
then if the developers are not prepared to put it right, then why don't they just compulsory purchase the building, do the work necessary, and then sell them back on the market at the current value,
yes.
The proper value.
Yes.
It is at the moment, you'd be able to pick them up for next to nothing because they wouldn't be able to sell them.
Yes, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if you were to compulsory purchase a building, what kind of knockdown price do you think you could get it for?
Well, they wouldn't be able to sell it to anybody else if it's unfit for human inhabitation.
Sure. Sure. No, I get that. But what I'm saying is, roughly speaking, would that mean that the government could compulsory purchase the building and then make a good profit which would pay for the cladding being put on in the end or being fixed?
And more.
Yeah. Right. And what would you say to what Ed's point was, which was that the builders who built the buildings in the first place, the owners, at the time, they believed that they were adhering to the right regulations?
Well, I think he's got a point.
Yeah.
But you know, things change. And, you know, if you're a property owner and the regulations change and you have to update things, then you have to update them.
Yes, well, exactly right. I mean, it's like somebody coming round to your house and saying, you know, years and years ago, you can't burn coal anymore. So you'd have to take the fireplace out and put something else in.
Yeah, you know, it happens all the time.
Yeah, no, you're right. Listen, it's a fascinating problem, this, because when I first started reading this story this morning, I thought to myself, well, of course, everybody's going to agree with James Brokenshire. Setting up a fund of 200 million quid is a good idea. It's a very, very fine way of safeguarding the public. It's exactly what should be done. But clearly, there are people who have got different views on it.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
This is, of course, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. We will take loads of your calls between now and 1 o'clock. 0344 499 1000 is the number. We'll be talking about Donald Trump coming up a little bit later on in the show as well, because there's all sorts of things going on. If you're a watcher of what happens in the White House, there's problems in Iran, there's problems in China. North Korea's just fired a missile. Nobody knows why. There's also, of course, the visit by Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, from the United States yesterday, who said that Jeremy Corbyn and others who supported Maduro in Venezuela were quite frankly disgusting. But let's talk about cycling, because cycling is something that everybody talks about on a daily basis in this country, because there's incidents where some people blame the cyclists, there's incidents where cyclists blame motorists, taxi drivers get problems, lorry drivers have problems, cyclists are killed. It's a terrible situation, but we all have to try and find a way of coexisting. Let's talk to Nick Chamberlain, policy manager at British Cycling. Nick, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, how are you doing?
Yeah, very well indeed. Thanks very much for joining us. It's quite a frightening study, this, if you're a cyclist. 70% of people out there on the road cycling basically say that drivers are often hostile towards them and that many of them feel unsafe on their bikes.
Yeah, it's a very blunt report that we've got from surveying our 150,000 members, who are a pretty representative group of the sorts of people who ride bikes, you know, on our roads and on our paths across the country at the moment. And it's a pretty bleak picture.
Yeah.
People saying that to do it is unpleasant and scary.
Yeah. But I mean, there's an awful lot of people doing it, so I guess it can't be that unpleasant and scary.
Absolutely. I think that's the critical thing. Look, we've got hundreds of thousands, millions of people in this country who do it. Either do it a lot, which is a hardcore, or do it a little bit. And actually, you know, the vast majority of families in this country probably will pull out some push bikes and go for a pedal, you know, every so often in the summer when the weather's nice.
Right.
I think the critical thing is, in you know, what we're highlighting in this report and what our members are really keen to say, is they may represent a hardcore group of people who really love cycling and all its facets, from BMX racing to commuting on their bikes into towns and cities. But the big job we've got is to convince more normal people at the moment who currently don't feel they've got any choice other than to drive their car everywhere, to get some of those people out of their cars for some journeys, for some short little journeys, journeys around town, journeys to the shops. And if it's really hostile and unpleasant for the hardcore of people who are willing to do it, there's absolutely no way we're going to convince more normal people to actually consider it in the first place.
Well, first of all, let me take my hat off to you for having the bravery and the strength to use the word normal, because that's been outlawed for many, many years, because I don't think we can define normal at all without getting into trouble with some group or other. So hats off to you for that. But one of the problems for me, Nick, is that I think the reason why people are sort of so anti-cycling, and not everybody is, of course, but there are sort of quite a large number of motorists who are, it's because of that kind of statement that you say you want people to get out of their cars. Well, it's not really for you to say, is it?
It isn't for me to say, and I think that's the really critical thing, and I think you summed it up just in your introduction to this piece. You know, we have done with trying to convince people or cajole people or tell people they ought to. We've got to build a world. We've got to build towns and cities in which people can make those choices for themselves. And our big concern at the moment is that people are not being given real choice. They're not being given options. People are absolutely, you know, tied to their cars, utterly understandably, because that is the only practical way that lots of people have of getting around and living their lives. Mm. We want to give people more options. And it's that choice that people have to make for themselves. You are quite right.
And what about the point I also made, which is that I don't think politicians have played a particularly sort of sensible role here. They've been very preachy about the whole thing. I mean, certainly in London, which is in my main sort of point of interest, although I know Glasgow reasonably well too, the cycle lanes that have been put in really, you know, very helpfully for cyclists. And I mean, I walk past Blackfriars Road every day, where if you're in a car or a bus, you are sitting in a line of traffic which isn't moving, and the only people getting anywhere are in the cycle lane. So I can perfectly well see, you know, why that has been done and why it's a good thing. However, you know, for everybody else, it's a terrible thing. And, you know, I just think the way that the politicians have done it has kind of pitted people against each other, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Look, you know, and politicians, you know, crikey, they're in the news an awful lot, you know, on a daily basis, but at the moment, full on. You know, it is the role of all of us to try and support politicians, local, national, everyone, to feel that they are empowered to do things that we as a society believe in. You know, that is our absolute job. And I think the other critical thing about our study that is so important to make, you know, not over 90% of our adult members are all car owners, they're car users, yeah, they're car drivers. And actually, we asked a very specific question. How do you, right now, these hardcore of riders, take most short journeys of under 3 miles? And still one third of them drive their cars, yeah, you know, because they are just normal people like the rest of us. And I'm unapologetically use that word again, you know, but actually as many of those people also as ride short journeys, also walk short journeys. So they are also the pedestrians that we see on our streets, you know. So again, it is about having that conversation in a sensible manner and saying, what sort of towns and cities do we want? You know, we do have cities clogged by pollution. No one wants that. No one wants to sit in pollution in their car, in their HGV, in their taxi, or walking or riding around.
No, but there's actually more
a strong conversation about it.
Well, we should, and we continue to have it, and we have lots of them on this radio show. However, what I would say is that there's more pollution probably now, certainly around where I am in Southwark, in southeast London, because of the fact that the traffic doesn't move at all, because we've had two lanes which were formerly going in both directions. We're now down to one lane going in each direction. And it's so confusing with all the different traffic lights and the street furniture that people talk about, the rights of way. You know, there's bikes coming at you from all over the place. I'm amazed there aren't more. I mean, if you stood on the street corner where my local tube station is, which I use because I'm a great believer in public transport, just in case you think I drive around in a horrible big smelly car, you know, you'll see incidents practically every 15 minutes between pedestrians and cyclists, between drivers and cyclists. You know, there's a massive problem.
Yeah, look, I think the most important thing, and, you know, I'm not a highways engineer, I defer to, you know, some fantastic people I talk to who are. The critical thing is that we just have to let this be evidence-led. And, you know, if that evidence says things that one group or another group doesn't like, well, that is just a hard thing that all of us have to accept. Mm. And, you know, it is a reality that at the moment our towns and streets, and let's remember, for our members as well, you know, a lot of them recreational riders at the weekend, it is our thousands of miles of rural roads as well that are important in this. It's not just our towns and cities. But the critical thing is, let's all have as calm and evidence-led and rational debate as we can around what the best thing is. And as you say, public transport is a fantastically important part of that. London, very lucky, amazing, world-leading public transport. Much of the rest of the Britain really, really struggled.
Yeah.
And that's all part of it as well.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. How about this? I've got a great tweet here from from Paul, who says, there's a difference between cyclists who get from A to B and cyclists who use public roads as their own personal training track. If I were to play football or cricket in the road, then I'd be worried. But the roads are not there for people to practice their sport. They are a means to an end, i.e. if you're travelling. And if you are working towards fitness and or getting some kind of a race ready, go to a velodrome.
Well, you know, I hear Paul. I'm not going to agree with him, I'm afraid. You probably expect that. You know, our roads.
I think he's got a good point. A good point. I mean, I do see, for example, I also spend a bit of time in the countryside of Sussex, and quite often at the weekends you'll see a peloton, which is not a word I even knew before 2012 when the Olympics came to Britain. But you know, you see people out there in a peloton, 15 maybe strong, cycling in a big group. You can't get around them because of the way that they're cycling. And, you know, that I know they've got to do that somewhere, but they're clearly sort of training for something.
Well, look, you know, actually, a vast majority of the people you see clad in lycra at the weekend and riding around are doing it because they enjoy it. It makes them fit and healthy, and it makes them feel good about themselves. You know, and that's something we're trying to promote in our society at the moment, is health and well-being and physical activity. I think the other thing, again, you know, just to highlight, you know, the vast majority of those people you see riding around, they are car owners, they are car users and car drivers, and they are choosing to use the roads, you know, at a particular point to be fit and healthy. I think poor behaviour is something that exists in all road user groups. We know that.
Yeah.
And poor behaviour is inexcusable in everyone. We certainly believe that, again, one of the biggest problems with our roads at the moment is a lack of policing, a lack of enforcement of everything from, you know, people in a car using a mobile phone to a cyclist jumping a red light. You know, all poor behaviour is being basically, you know, allowed now because we have such poor enforcement on our roads, and we want to see the arms of our road policing teams, you know, strengthened in future, because that's the only way that we're going to get a handle on this.
Where do you stand on the conversation about registration and insurance and all of that? Because a lot of people who you might consider to be anti-cyclists, and I don't count myself as anti-cyclist, I just want people to behave correctly and to observe the rules of the road, you know what I mean? But there's a lot of people who feel as though, you know, if a cyclist does run into them and doesn't stop, you have no way of knowing who it is. You have no way of snapping a picture of the bike and then tracking them down. Whereas if they did have to have some kind of registration, that might appease a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, look, again, and you know, we do genuinely understand when people make calls for these things. I think what we just say again is let the evidence lead on these sorts of conversations. There is absolutely no evidence from anywhere across the whole globe that trying to do something like this works. And as horrendous as it sounds, you know, this is no different to any other level of the world where people walk around on a daily basis without any, you know, license plate showing on them. You know, when someone, you know, pushes someone in a street, equally again, you know, you can't necessarily trace them. This is back again. What we need is really good road policing. We need good police on our streets. And we think that that is one of the issues at the moment that has led to some of this, you know, really, really angst-ridden behaviour in our streets.
Yeah, but I mean, it's very unlikely somebody's going to push you in the street and you're going to die. But you could be run over by a cyclist and you could be very, very seriously injured, if not killed. So it's a different, slightly different situation.
Yeah. And again, we have to go back to evidence. And what we would say is, you know, in the instances where that has happened, actually, the conviction rate, the arrest rate for someone on a bike is actually higher, if you look at it, than for the vast majority of incidents where someone in a car kills or seriously injures someone on the road.
Yeah.
So just because a car has license plate, that doesn't, if you look at the statistics and you let the evidence lead, that doesn't necessarily lead
no, it
to
doesn't.
Capture
but,
and conviction.
But a lot of people will be listening to you, Nick, and thinking, well, why wouldn't you want to do it? Because surely it would, at the very least, it would give people a sense that something was being done, because there is a sense that cyclists are quite obdurate, quite obstinate. You know, they think they own the road. They think that they've got a right to do what they do, but you've got no right to criticise them for it. And I think it would go a long way towards getting good PR for the cycling community, which surely isn't a bad thing.
Yeah, look, and again, it's, you know, I'm going to use that horrible term again around normal people. You know, there are lots of people who jump on a bike every so often throughout the year. We want kids to ride to school. I think it's around the practicalities of these schemes. You know, if there was a practical way of implementing it and enforcing it, and we had best practice from somewhere in the rest of the world to say that this was a thing that worked and was achievable, okay, let's have a discussion around it. But that is not what the evidence is showing us. And we think there are better things and more important things that we should be focusing on that will help to enforce good behaviour and responsible behaviour on our roads.
Yeah, no, I get all that, and I don't disagree with it, but I don't see any problem with, say, for example, having a little square number plate on the bottom of a saddle, which you could have on every bike that's purchased. And if a new bike is purchased, you've got it, and if you've got an older bike, then you can take it somewhere and have that put on. It's very straightforward, that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, ironically, pretty much every single metal-framed bicycle that comes out of a factory anywhere in the world has exactly that. It has a unique number print stamped on the bottom of it. And in cases of bike theft, that is what the police use to be able to track that bicycle, you know.
Oh, yeah,
the owner.
The police spend loads of time tracking stolen bikes.
Yeah, well, again, you know, but all I'm highlighting is the fact that actually there is a mechanism right now if you wanted to go down that route. The reality is I think there are much more effective and much more immediate and impactful ways of having a discussion around how we enforce good behaviour on our roads.
Sure. Well, so how would you go about, and I know that maybe you're going to tell me it's an impossible task, but how would you go about preventing more of these rather unsavoury incidents, right? Where many times, cyclists are to blame, many times car drivers are to blame. I mean, how are we going to solve it? Because at the moment, it's daggers drawn time.
It can be in some places. It can be daggers drawn. I think the critical and most important thing is, as you say, we need government, national and local, to really front up and give some real responsibility for this. And to say that, look, you know, our society is changing, our roads, our towns are changing, and we need to invest in local places, actually in the roads right outside people's front doors. You know, the roads, the local roads that people use on a daily basis. We need to invest in them, and we need to give people, whether they're walking, riding a bike, riding a horse, driving a car, safe places in order to do all of those things.
But we've spent a lot of money in London. Billions have been spent on the cycle lane. So, I mean, there's no shortage of investment for cyclists, but there's not much investment for motorists.
Well, again, you know, the money that's been spent on cycle lanes and other improvements is still a tiny fraction of what is spent in the transport budget by Transport for London every year. Again, we need everyone in society to get behind that conversation and let people know what they want to be done. But we do know that we're in a world where we need to do something about how people move around towns and cities and around this country, because what we've got at the moment, you know, is unpleasant. It's not nice to be in a car. It's not nice to walk. It's not nice to ride a bike. So we've got to change, and I think we just need to make sure that we're having an evidence-led debate around what is important and how we go about it.
Absolutely right. Well, that's what we do here at Talk Radio. Nick, thanks very much indeed. Nick Chamberlain, Policy Manager at British Cycling. Let's have an evidence-led debate, just as he has asked for.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio, via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.